Good afternoon, everyone. It is Tim Pichot. It is the 15th day of March. It is a Thursday. And today the theme is being consistent. And what I want to talk about on today's podcast is first, I want to get a few things off my chest. And I want to talk about a little bit about politics, which is going to blend into the markets. And then I want to get into a recent encounter I had with the police. But first, I want to give a little wrap up of my talk at Anarchapoco. So first and foremost, I want to thank all of my subscribers and for everyone listening and for sharing this with your friends and family. A lot of time, only the critics are the ones responding to me, and it gets lonely having to constantly battle people who, you know, just don't get it. But I know that I have a lot of love and support out there, and I greatly appreciate that. So Anarchapoco is the largest gathering of voluntarists worldwide in Acapulco, Mexico, which leads to the question, okay, what does voluntarist mean? Voluntarist to me is someone who I'd rather categorize as a leave-me-alonist. I don't want to tell you what to do, and conversely, I don't want you telling me what to do, provided that what I'm doing is not adversely affecting you. Sort of like a golden rule type atmosphere. Now, a lot of people refer to themselves as anarchists, which tends to be, a lot of people who are there refer to themselves as anarchists, which tends to be a scary word for many. But the reason it's a scary word is because you know, what's the first thing that pops up in your head when you hear the word anarchy? You're probably thinking of, you know, these country club kids who are going to Berkeley with black masks. Maybe they're burning cars or causing chaos, demanding free stuff, and more than likely promulgating the ideals of socialism. Well, that anarchy and what I'm talking about are complete polar opposites. That anarchy is a media contrived term that is actually describing most of the isms that you see out there, whether it's socialism, communism, fascism, so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, there's not a whole hell of a lot of difference between all those isms. And at the end of the day, what you have is, in all those situations, you have a tiny amount of people that are ruling everyone. In anarchy, you have no one ruling, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have no rules. Now, most people, if there wasn't a government, you know, they're not going to just go out and start murdering people and doing heroin. I mean, not to mention, you know, the government that's bringing in the heroin to begin with and government that does a better job murdering people than just about anyone else that's out there. But most people, they have a moral compass and they're, you know, they might be religious and most people are just good, decent human beings trying to make a living. Now, for the person out there who's just hearing about this concept for the first time, maybe the best way to explain this would be through the lens of one of the libertarian candidates for president, Adam Kokesh. And if you haven't checked this out, I did a podcast with Adam a few months ago. He was actually the first guest we ever had on the show. So make sure to check that out. I think it's episode 7 or 6, right around there. Great, great episode, about an hour long. And it was, I think it's actually one of the first episodes Adam did, you know, after announcing his run for president. But the platform that Adam is running on is actually to abolish the federal government. And yes, I know it sounds extreme, but what the federal government, but you know, what I want to ask you is, what is the federal government better at doing than the states? You know, obviously besides, you know, murdering people both, you know, abroad and domestically, extorting people, running drugs into the country, you know, really not sure there's a whole lot that the federal government is better equipped at dealing with than the state government. Now, you can get into issues such as, you know, nuclear weapons and defending America, but, you know, that's not really what I wanted this whole podcast to be. I just wanted to really set the stage of why I was at Anarchapoco. Okay, so getting back to Adam's campaign platform, it's simple. Let's say you're living in California and you want socialism, then okay, you can have your socialism. It's bringing everything down to the local level, and ideally it'd be bringing it down to a level even more local within California. Now, if you're in Arizona, like I am, and actually like Adam is as well, and you just want to have more of like a leave-me-alone-ist, keep everything at the local level, rugged individualism, well then you can have that too. Now from a moral standpoint, I actually think it's the most moral standpoint because you aren't forcing your views on anyone. Now the hardcore anarchists are probably mad at me for even mentioning, you know, the thought of California forming their own socialist country, which would be a government and, you know, upon the dissolution of the federal government. But, you know, a lot of these people live in bubbles where they, you know, aren't really talking to anybody outside their little five friends or spheres and had never convinced anyone of anyone. So never convinced anyone else of anything. So, you know, I don't really want to hear it. Now, if you think about it, democracy is, it's sort of like that Hollywood version of anarchy we have, you know. So our country, you know, and democracy ultimately is a mob rule, you know, not too much different from, you know, what you think of anarchy being. So our country was set up as a constitutional republic and not a democracy, which sort of leads me to the Tocqueville quote, Alexander de Tocqueville or Alexis de Tocqueville. Sort of trying to remember his name and this quote from my humanities class that I took, which was probably one of the only really beneficial classes I did take in college. And I'm not looking at this quote right now, but it's something along the lines of, you know, if you ever allow people to vote, once the public realizes that they can start voting themselves from the public trough, then at that point, you know, the entire economy will, or the entire society collapses because they just keep voting themselves more and more money. Just butchered it in that quote, but that's basically the general sentiment. And the last thing I'm going to comment on in this situation is, you know, we have a, you know, right now we've got a huge amount of people in America that think Trump is a traitor, a Russian agent. And yeah, I think those people are now, they're not calling me a conspiracy theorist anymore because, you know, their conspiracy theories are a lot crazier than any of the ones that I've ever talked about, which most of them have, you know, proven to be conspiracy facts. But moving along, you know, then you've got another huge amount of the country that thinks Hillary is a traitor and deserves to be thrown in jail. And if you need any evidence on this, I did write a blog piece on this. I think it was entitled Hillary's Many Crimes, Lies, Distortions, and I don't know. I'll put it into the show notes so you guys can obviously, you know, probably, you know, figure where I stand on this issue. Then you've got the other half of the country that, you know, hate both candidates or apathetic to both candidates enough that they don't even vote. And, you know, is this really a functional way to live? Because you got, you know, what it's called, 25% of the country thinks Trump's a traitor, 25% thinks Hillary's a traitor, and the other 50% don't even give a fuck. And, or maybe they do care, and they do care about the kids and grandkids, but, you know, they all realize that, you know, none of this politics even matters. And a lot of people are, you know, out there, you know, probably lazy, or they don't want to be bothered, or they're completely empathetic to this whole entire thing. But, you know, really, I just wanted to kind of paint the groundwork of why I was at Anarchapoco and the Dollar Vigilante Internationalization and Investment Summit that I'll abbreviate as the TDV Investment Summit. So there was actually 1,700 people there. All the people I talked to were incredibly intelligent, most of them pretty wealthy. All of them that I talked to were very, very well read. You know, this is not some conference of bubbling idiots at Berkeley who can, you know, barely tie, you know, their own shoelaces. I can definitely tell you that. Now, a lot of people here, they're working on some pretty cool projects, you know, that really have the ability to really change, you know, the course of humanity. Again, not going to get into that right now, but, you know, very, very positive atmosphere where politics, you know, almost didn't come up at all. So let's fast forward to the TDV Investment Summit. So the TDV Investment Summit was the day after Anarchapoco, and it was a little bit smaller than the main conference. So there was 500 people there. But I've never spoken in front of, I think, more than like 60 or 70, of which I knew most people. And actually, it might even be harder to talk in front of people you know because, you know, they know you and, you know, it's a little bit more embarrassing. And I think it was almost harder for me to give this presentation when I practiced it in front of Ernest Hancock than it was for me to give it in front of 500 people. But, you know, it was a huge, huge experience. And how this all came about was, or the companies I'm about to launch right now with how all this ties in is, you know, there was a pool party probably back in August, you know, early September, and there was a lot of, you know, rich crypto guys there, early adopters, and, you know, being the financial planner at the party, you know, the host of the party, Ernest Hancock's like, hey, you know, we need to figure out a way to, you know, I guess if I back up one more step, is there was an elderly gentleman there who didn't have any kids, didn't have, you know, a wife, had no heirs. And it's like, hey, what are we going to do for him when he passes away? Or how do we make sure that his wealth is able to then, you know, fight for the same causes that he held near and dear to his heart? So this is really the genesis of this whole entire thing. And, you know, maybe this isn't going to necessarily be the best plan for this gentleman. What I've come up with is I teamed up with the foundation that is able to do strategies that are very similar to, let's say, you know, what Bill Gates does, maybe at the Gates Foundation or Warren Buffett. Well, I guess he used the Gates Foundation, so maybe a bad example. But in essence, these people, they are getting massive, massive upfront tax breaks for doing what they're doing. And then those tax breaks are then able to then offset the income they're getting. And meanwhile, they can move highly appreciated businesses, or let's say Microsoft stock in Bill Gates' example, or you know, Facebook stock in Zuckerberg's example, where they're then not going to have to trigger paying capital gains. Now, they will have to pay income tax on this, but they also, the money's inside of there, it's growing tax-free, which is then also helping negate some of those effects. So there are very, very advanced ways where we can essentially make sure that everybody except for the IRS is better off. So the Dollar Vigilante Summit crowd is probably one of the best crowds in the entire world for me to present on this. So when I got the opportunity to present there, when really it was much quicker than I anticipated, because I was not ready to roll this out, but you know, when you get this opportunity, you know, you've got to make it work. So the other side of the coin, no pun intended, what I'm doing is we're doing self-directed IRAs where people can put virtually anything into their IRA. And yeah, it's a shameless plug right here. This is what we're doing, but you know, we've got to fund ourselves somehow. So with these IRAs, you can put crypto into your IRAs. So again, a great crowd to be in front of. I think that I am the first. I'm almost positive I'm the first certified financial planner doing this, and almost positive I'm the first licensed person out there who's doing both of the estate planning aspect of things, through the foundations we're working with and through lawyers, and probably the first licensed person to do this, to do these crypto IRAs as well. So very, very exciting. This was the absolute crowd that I needed to be in front of. And a couple of my heroes have been G. Edward Griffin, who wrote the book Creature from Jekyll Island. Jekyll Island is the name of the island off the coast of Georgia that J.P. Morgan hatched the plan for the Federal Reserve. Sounds like a boring topic. It's not, trust me, not only because I'm a financier, but this is an incredibly important book that everybody needs to read, Creature from Jekyll Island. So I'm going backstage. He's back there, one of my biggest heroes. Then you've got Mike Maloney of the Hidden Secrets of Money series. I would really recommend Hidden Secrets of Money Part 4 and Part 8. Again, can't recommend that enough. So he was also backstage. So I'm like, this is pretty crazy. So like, not only am I about to talk in front of 500 people, but I've got Mike Maloney and G. Edward Griffin there. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. Now, I would say overall, I did a pretty good job. I mean, one thing I did a good job of was, not to pat myself on the back here too much, is I actually did talk pretty slow, you know, and I would say even in general, I did a good job of making sure I didn't speed things up, because I have a tendency, as I'm sure all of you know, where my brain's going a million miles an hour, and I'm sure a lot of yours, you guys do the same thing too, where, you know, all of a sudden, I know I start speeding up, start talking really fast. Well, I did a good job of not doing that, so I'd say, you know, I give myself about an 8 out of 10 on that performance. And you know, one aspect that you know I didn't completely nail that I wish I nailed is that a really great closing I was gonna say, and then I ran out of time, panicked, lost where I was on my little teleprompter app I had in my phone, and you know, oh well, nobody knew what I was gonna close with. But you know, I think before I got off stage, I had 26 people email me about getting together, and I think it ended up being like 30 people who watched that all together, of which I've already met with, a few people, just give them like informational meetings. Again, I can't actually start working again until the registered investment advisory that I'm partnering with up in Massachusetts, till they get licensed in Arizona. Did that the first day I got back. So, I mean, that should be within 2 weeks that we can get rocking and rolling again. Got to start moving the clients over first. And at that point, we're going to then go to all the people that express interest in this new platform. So again, if you guys are listening to this and you know someone that's interested in crypto, or maybe they already have a massive amount of crypto gains, then you know, send them my way. I had to literally quit my job in order to come down here and you know, risked a lot, and that's not easy to do. I mean, I finally built up over six figures of revenue coming in at 32 years old with a young family, and you know, if I had to do it over again, I'm not even sure I would have. I had to just put myself through and my family through a lot to be able to do all this. But I know, and I absolutely know with all my heart, that this is going to work out. So, you know, put your money with the good guys, put your money with the guys who care, put your money with the guys who know what's going on. And not to segue off into, you know, what's going on with a little bit in the economy, because really how I see things unraveling, and this wasn't where I wanted to take things, but we're just, you know, free flowing here, is how I see things happening is I see interest rates eventually starting to get out of control, which, because of the current situation we've got ourselves into, out of control, could be literally like 4 or 5% on the 10-year bond, could be out of control because the debt is so great. And then the 20 trillion number they throw around doesn't even include Social Security, doesn't include Medicare, that's more than Social Security. And so my thesis is that you're going to see the government have a hard time paying its interest. You're going to see interest being creeping up, being more and more and more a part of the percent of the federal budget, at which point that's probably going to make the stock market go down, at which point the government's going to, or Federal Reserve will come in to buy the bonds to help lower the interest rates so that way they can afford the debt again, at which point, the dollar could then go down, at which point you're then seeing the stock market go through the roof potentially. One example I like to use is Germany in early 1900s had the Goldmark, Renmark, Reichmark, Deutschmark. So if you're holding on to 100 shares of Mercedes-Benz, maybe now through compounding, maybe now you had 102 shares that were priced, that so you had 100 shares that were in Goldmark, and now I think it was Renmark was next. So then maybe now you had 102 priced in Renmark, and then when that collapsed, you had maybe 103, 104 that were priced in Reichmark. But if you're holding on to paper or you're holding on to bonds, you were wiped out. You were given, maybe 10 cents in the dollar every time. And, it's a tricky situation. Not sure exactly how it's going to unfold. But, one thing that I'm very upset with Trump is, and again, this goes back to the theme of being consistent, is that in June 2016, Trump was calling the stock market a bubble. He was saying that, this is a big, fat, ugly bubble. He was saying that I forgot the exact quote to use, but he talked about the unemployment numbers and saying that they're the biggest bunch of baloney. Well, now that they're his baloney, he wants to, use it for all it's worth and ride that horse. Now, actually, the last jobs numbers that came out, they actually did look pretty good. A lot of times it's very easy for me to tear holes in these, kind of give you the real news on what's going on. But this last one that came out actually did look pretty good, surprisingly. But I think that's more of an aberration. Because, if you've got, 50 in a row that where I can tear holes through and there's one that happens to be good, well, okay, that's the aberration, not the other way around. And again, let's get back to being consistent. Can you imagine a world where Hillary had won and the Dems wanted to raise the debt limit? All these fake-ass Republicans, you can almost guarantee, would be, up in arms about, how you can't do this to the next generation. And they're all full of shit, every single one of them. And all these Republicans who want to get on their high horse and, every time talk about how they're the party of fiscal responsibility, kiss my ass. You guys have done nothing but, really it's just at the point now where, this is going to be the biggest budget ever released, the one that just came out. And, let's have $150 billion more to the military, which is, the increase is, twice as much as what Russia even spends. And so that way we can build more aircraft carriers and fight yesterday's war when all those aircraft carriers are going to get blown up by a hypersonic missile. And thanks for playing. I mean, the generals are always fighting the war, yesterday's war. And I think they're completely ill-prepared and they just want to go waste a whole bunch of money through all their military industrial contractor friends, which, Hillary, I'm sure if she was in there, would probably be raised, but she's a big warmonger, probably even much bigger warmonger than Trump. I can almost guarantee that. And I'm sure if she was in there, we'd probably already be at war with Russia. So again, I've got to make, little caveats to all these statements that, almost nobody worked harder to try to get Trump elected than me. Spent, 2 months before the election getting this Libertarian Advisor page up off the ground from complete obscurity to, all of a sudden reaching millions of people the week of the election, reaching several million people the months leading up to the election. And again, this was from a standstill. And so I only spent like about $1,000 in ads. And again, you do the numbers reaching millions of unique people. I mean, hell, you give me $10,000 and, I'm going to swing an entire election in terms of, getting things out into the culture, getting things out of the ethos. And in really, it's just very disheartening now, anytime I point out any little criticism of Trump to then try to get him back on the straight path over here, the people are just absolutely on me, just trying to wreck me apart. And so it's just crazy that, here I am going from obscurity to getting like over a quarter million post engagements right before the election, getting almost a million post likes even before that. And again, it's not about likes, it's not about being popular, it's about getting this information out of there. So, here I am, spent countless hours, didn't make any money off of this. I could have sold out and went the, Trump MAGA route and just everything, trying to, absolutely ride that gravy train. And I didn't, because I've got, a conscience And, you know, I've got to live with myself. And obviously Trump getting in there was a lot of good things that happened. You know, we got rid of the TPP. And some people were saying, okay, well, the TPP is free trade. Well, I'm not – nothing in the TPP was about free trade. It was this high-tech, basically global enslavement plan that I've actually read parts of it that were leaked on WikiLeaks and nothing to do with free trade. But I also don't agree with all these tariffs either. I mean, do you really want to get into a trade war with our largest holder of our debt? And I do remember I was at a party several years ago and someone said, hey, you know, if you owe somebody $100, you know, you've got a problem. You know, if you owe somebody $1 million, they have a problem. Well, it's the same thing with China. You know, if you owe somebody owes you $4 trillion, well, they have the problem. And so they already know that we're going to pay it back with deflated dollars. You know, they're not idiots over there. You know, the Asians have very, very high IQs. But, you know, what I see going on right now is so much hypocrisy with, you know, the, you know, Republicans, you know, launching this huge budget increase, and the Republicans launching, you know, raising the debt limit. And then here we've got, you know, can you imagine if Hillary Clinton made the same comments about gun control that Donald Trump did, that some of these people would just be absolutely up in arms, as it should be. But now that Trump said it, you know, they're giving him cover for all this, and they're giving him, you know, oh, well, you know, it's part of this 4D chess and you wouldn't understand it. And, you know, then you've got, you know, can you imagine if Hillary appointed Gina Haspel, you know, the little CIA torture chief over there. And then you have to ask yourself, and I will give Trump credit on this. I do like the appointment of Larry Kudlow, but why was Gary Cohn even in there in the first place? You know, he was an absolute globalist. And oh yeah, let's make this a little aside now. Now they're trying to say that if you use the word globalist, you're really trying to make an anti-Semitic remark, because, you know, here we are talking about guys like, you know, George Soros, how he was rounding up the Jews for the Nazis, and now if you criticize him, now you're anti-Semitic. So, you know, it's funny the circular logic all these people use. But what I want to get back to is that I have been consistent. I'm going to call people out, you know, regardless of what party they're in, when they're lying, when they're not being consistent, and when I think they're selling out the country. Right now, you know, I don't know what the overall game plan is, but appointing people like Gina Haspel, who is the ultimate deep state insider, and people are like, oh, well, you've got to have someone from the deep state, to, you know, running the CIA to then help get rid of the deep state bullshit. I mean, that is the dumbest logic I've ever heard. And yeah, I know there's all sorts of logic that says, you know, why don't you go, you know, you hire the best hacker to, you know, to help protect against, safeguard against your own, you know, website. You know, I think that that is obviously going to be a little bit different. So getting back to the economy right now, I mean, there's no way out of this current situation that we're in right now. We just saw recently the Atlanta Fed, again, I'm not looking at notes, so I think they went from a estimate of about 5.4, 5.2 down to now we're below 2% GDP estimates. I mean, even Obama was at like 2.2, and then Trump last year was at 2.3, so he's not doing that much better than Obama, but yet, you know, 2.2 is complete economic stagnation, and somehow 2.3% GDP growth is this like economic Shangri-La. So, I mean, I'm just all for being consistent. And if you're going to, you know, act like 2.3% is the greatest thing since sliced bread, then you've got to give Obama some credit too for having 2.2%. Otherwise, you're basically just a hypocrite. And speaking of hypocrites, I mean, how much of a hypocritical move was it to appoint Jerome Powell as head of the Federal Reserve? I mean, Trump campaigned on Janet Yellen keeping interest rates, you know, very low, was trying to help out Obama, and that he would get rid of Janet Yellen. Well, now he basically picked Janet Yellen's clone, but in the form of a man, Jerome Powell, who was a huge opponent of auditing the Federal Reserve. He was a Carlyle investment guy, you know, as business as usual as it possibly can go. And he wants Jerome to keep the interest rates low, and he wants, you know, basically all the same goodies that Obama got. Because, I mean, again, Obama was on, you know, essentially had a 0% credit card for 8 years. So it's like if your neighbor is $1 million in debt and is on the verge of bankruptcy and then somehow gets, you know, a $4 million line of credit at 0% for 4 years and then goes nuts and he starts buying Lamborghinis and living the good life, look at him from the outside looking in, you might think, hey, things are going pretty good. Not sure what happened. But when you know the numbers and realize, oh, well, you know, he just borrowed four times as much money. Well, then all of a sudden the situation doesn't look nearly as promising. So I'm just sick and tired of all this business as usual crap that's going on, because it's not for the good of the American people. And really what we're doing is, I mean, that's really why right now I'm trying to focus on building the off-ramps to the financial system through blockchain. And I'm really at the point now where I don't really give a shit what happens at this point, because The cake is already baked, and you know the Republicans right now are treading on real thin ice and are going to risk losing the House to the Dems, at which point their renewed focus is going to be on impeachments, and Trump's going to be able to get nothing done those last 2 years. And then when and if the economy does go, which more than likely it's probably not going to make it another, you know, until 2020, that's the capitalism's going to get the blame. It's going to pave the way for a, you know, Biden-Warren ticket or a, you know, Warren, whatever his name is, Bernie Sanders ticket. And then really all of Trump's accomplishment, what would have mattered? Okay, great. We got to stall things out for 4 years because I already see how this is going to be. You know, capitalism is going to get the blame for this because we're going to say, hey, we gave all those big tax cuts to the rich and to the wealthy, to the one percenters and to the business owners. And, you know, you need to elect Bernie Sanders because he cares about you, when we all know that's crap. And just look at what's going on in Venezuela. But really, I mean, look at the metrics. After 4 years of Trump, will the government have gotten bigger or smaller? It's going to be bigger. Entitlements, bigger or smaller? They're going to be bigger. Military, bigger. Trade deficits, bigger. The deficits, bigger. The debt, bigger. And all this is really going to mean jack shit in terms of everything Trump has done if the economy is still built on quicksand. And by quicksand, I mean in order to get a dollar into the system, you have to create a dollar of debt. This is why, you know, Mike Maloney of the two guys that spoke before me at TDB Investment Summit, Mike Maloney and Gio Griffin, probably have two of the best pieces on this. But essentially what we're trying to get at is the only way to get money into the system is to create debt. So if the money is debt, then if you got rid of all your debt, you get rid of all your money. It's a very, you know, and I do have a little video made on this called, It's called Why We're All Slaves to Central Bankers. I'll try to put that into the show notes as well. So all this does not matter. All this for naught. And I see all this, you know, well, we got to compromise here. We got to compromise there. We got to compromise there. And Trump said this, but, you know, he really didn't mean that. And people giving him cover and cover and cover. And how I want to transition this right now is that my central tenet has been the same people that think, let's say, the police are to blame for everything, I think are just as guilty or as culpable for the situation that's been created as the people who think that the police are never to blame. Now, I try to evaluate things on a, you know, case-by-case basis. So, you know, a lot of these police shootings, the past several years, at least 2 years, you could see that there was a media narrative that the media wanted to take all these nebulous cases where, you know, sometimes it was hard to really see, you know, one way or the other what was going on. And they wanted to just get people fighting, you know, white versus black, you know, police versus non-police, you know, mainly white versus black was what the media was trying to ramp up. So, you know, I sort of gave the police a little bit of a pass for the last 2 years because, you know, I saw that they were getting a pretty raw end of the deal out of this. I saw that, you know, obviously there was a, you know, they were sort of this, they were at the receiving end of this media propaganda. But, you know, there have been so many cases. I mean, if I spent the time looking, probably find thousands, easily find, you know, dozens of super egregious cases, probably, you know, super easily within, you know, about 20 minutes, I could find so many open and shut cases. Well, it's funny because those open and shut cases are almost never the ones that the media wants to focus on. I mean, remember there was this Kelly Thomas, who was a homeless man with schizophrenia, who is begging for his daddy, which I think his dad actually was former law enforcement, this guy was, you know, brutally murdered. And here's, you got, you know, a mentally handicapped schizophrenic homeless guy who's murdered. You've got another guy out in New Mexico where the police officer actually said, you know, hey, we're going to go shoot this guy in the dick. We're sick of dealing with him. And then they go out there and they execute him on camera for the crime of camping in a national park or something. And again, open shot execution on camera. Nothing happens to them. Nothing happens to the Kelly Thomas case, which I can't even remember. I can't even remember that name off the top of my head. And then most disturbingly is recently, about 40 miles away from where I'm recording this, is down in Mesa, Arizona. You had a police officer who was playing really this game of high stakes, I guess we would call Simon Says, where he's given this guy who's intoxicated, who's already on the ground, who already has his hands behind his head, who doesn't look like he's that much of a threat, and he's giving him all these instructions, like, we need you to put this over that and that over this, and you know, I don't know, like it's a game of Twister or something, and he's like, and by the way, you know, if you fall, you know, you're not to put your hands out, or else we're going to shoot you, and we're going to kill you, and all this. And anyways, I mean, the guy, you know, the guy is crying, the guy is, clearly, it doesn't want to be there. And then the police goes and they executed him on camera, complete execution. And then he had his sergeant in the ear the whole time yelling at him to do all this stuff. And again, what happens to him? Nothing. Absolutely nothing happens to him. And so you see case after case after case where the police are emboldened, and you see people out there who will never have found a piece of case brutality that they somehow can't, dismiss away or say, well, if we really use some sort of crazy mental gymnastics, we can figure out some sort of justification of why it was okay for this guy to shoot this person. But, I do know they're underneath a lot of undue duress and in certain circumstances, and I know that the media was giving them a very bad shake. And so for the past 2 years, I feel partially ashamed of myself that I have not done more to expose the times when the police have been in the wrong. Because if you think that the police have never been in the wrong, then you're a idiot and you're just as to blame. As a matter of fact, you're probably even more to blame than the Black Lives Matter crowd. Because at least the Black Lives Matter crowd, they've been propagandized and, they don't see through all the media BS. They don't see through the Operation Mockingbird where you've got all these intelligence agencies and they're feeding the media what to do, what to say. The police crowd should be smarter than that crowd. So I'm willing to say that the police crowd is even more to blame than the Black Lives Matter crowd, which again could be a controversial statement. But let me get back to how things used to be, let's say in the 1950s police officer situation versus today. And in the 50s, you had your neighborhood police officer and, like a Leave It to Beaver type situation. And, they were there to actually help the public. They weren't there wearing black masks and looking like Al-Qaeda or something with, all this military gear. Like they're getting ready to, invade somebody in like Fallujah or something. Where, and where I'm all going with this with my police encounter, and let me back up just a second so a lot of people can understand where I'm coming from, is, some of you may have already heard the story, some of you haven't, but in 2000, I think it was 2013, I was out swimming at Lake Pleasant, Arizona, pretty remote part. Lake Pleasant is pretty remote, and the portion of the lake that I was in was super, super remote. And so here I am, just finished swimming 2.5 miles, it's 111 degrees outside, and we see a guy kind of flailing around, not really sure what's going on. I wasn't sure if he was, calling for jet skiers to go pick him up or if he's just dicking around drunk. I really had no idea what was going on. But then after a few seconds, we realized, okay, there's a chance this guy could be drowning. So I jumped in the water, swam about a football field, got the guy. Right before I went to go get him, he actually went limp. So, it was probably a blessing because if he didn't go limp, odds were what he would try to do is he'd probably then try to drag me down or try to drown me. Because you've got someone who's on literally their dying breath. And so on your dying breath, especially if you're in a situation where you're drowning and you don't know how to swim, and it means you probably haven't worked any these situations out, that, I was fully prepared to have to go and knock the guy out. Luckily I've got a nice 6'7" wingspan. Luckily I've trained as a lifeguard how to do evasive techniques. Luckily, I was, captain of the water polo team, captain of the swim team, 2-time Ironman triathlete. Actually, I think 1 time at that point, top 1% swim the Ironman, had all these different credentials where, I felt pretty comfortable going out there versus the average person. And just backing things up a little bit from there is actually right before I went out there, I was meeting with a payroll wholesaler, and he's like, hey, what you doing after this? And told him, hey, I'm going to go out to Lake Pleasant. And he's like, well, hey, didn't somebody die out there last week? I'm like, well, actually, somebody that rescued somebody died. And then he asked me what I would do in that situation. And then I went and told him and sort of reenacted what I would do. And then 4 hours later, I had to do it. So, I'm not somebody that, just talks, I'm not somebody that's full of hot air. I can back up what I say. I told somebody what I would do. Then 4 hours later, I had to go do it. And really, I think God was testing me. He was putting me in that situation. And I knew it was something where, if I just let man out there drown, that I wouldn't be able to live myself. Now, the very first thing they teach you when you go to get, when you become a lifeguard is basically don't ever go into a situation without a rescue buoy, because it could be very, very dangerous. People are trying to pull you down, very dangerous situation. They basically say everything that I just did, don't go ahead and do that. But I knew that I felt very confident in my skills and ability that I could be able to do that. And so swam the guy back to shore. Mind you, this was only kicking, so I had both my arms up underneath his armpits, and my head was down underneath the water and breathing, you know, every, you know, whenever I needed to take a breath. But I was doing the breaststroke kick, which this guy also got super lucky that I happened to be a breaststroke specialist. And that's the exact, so that's like a frog kick for those of you who don't know. To, you know, that was my specialty. So, I mean, I did, so I was able to get him back to shore relatively quickly. I didn't have to swim 100 yards back to shore. Where I was standing, it was this weird situation where I had to swim a lot farther to get to him than I did to swim back to shore. His were two different areas that we're at. So I swam back to shore. I don't know, maybe it was like 15, 20 yards or something. And he was completely lifeless, completely unresponsive. And it was very, very, you know, tricky situation that I was dealing with here, you know, very scary situation. And so I did CPR for roughly 15 minutes, mind you, 111 degree heat, and got the guy breathing again. And then he had to be helicoptered out of there, and he ended up living. And in the next year, Sheriff Joe, who's recognized for being one of the most notorious badasses and sheriffs in America, awarded me the 2014 Maricopa County Lifesaver Award for having one of the most heroic acts in my entire county. So, so the other day I'm out biking and I see a police officer go by me with his lights on, and there was an accident right up ahead. And again, I'm on my bike. And so then the police officer got there probably, I don't know, maybe about 3 minutes before me. And so I saw, you know, maybe there's like six cars there that were backed up at the time. And my thought process is, okay, well, this wreck looks pretty bad. I mean, there could be multiple people that are injured. Maybe you've got multiple people bleeding out. Maybe you've got somebody in cardiac arrest. You've got one police officer who, by the time I got there, it looked like he was on the side of on the right-hand side of the road just talking with, I think there was like three or four people there. Not sure if there were other people in the other cars who had come to the scene before him, or if they were the victims, or I was really trying to gauge what was going on to, A, you know, if I was in this, and again, this was actually on Lake Pleasant Parkway. So here I am. I performed that miracle on Lake. This is not to tout myself up or anything, but I performed that miracle on Lake Pleasant. And then here I am on Lake Pleasant Parkway in another pretty remote area that's just starting to get back into civilization. And so another part of the story is that's really the only road back into Phoenix that there is. And it would probably be like a half an hour detour by car to get around that. And with a car, you're able to take a highway that you can't go on with a bike. So with a bike, I'd have to go on another highway that you are allowed to go on with a bike that's sort of sketchy. That probably would have been about 35 miles. If I were to go on the, take a little bit safer route, we're talking about 50 mile detour, judging by where I'm at. And if you don't believe me, go to, you know, Google search Lake Pleasant, Arizona, and you'll see that, you know, 99% of areas of Phoenix, it's a grid, and okay, no big deal. You go down one street, go up the other, no big deal. Well, I wasn't in that area. So I was in a very remote area where, you know, I was, you know, probably about 4 or 5 miles away from my house. We're headed to a marriage retreat, which I've never been to before. And believe me, I would have rather dealt with some asshole cop and gotten arrested than have to deal with a wife who was like, well, you know, why did you miss this retreat? Because it's not like I could just, you know, okay, now let's just go on a nice 35 mile detour, you can say. So anyways, I've got the bike straddled between my legs. I'm kind of like tiptoeing, trying to gauge the situation, because the easiest way for me to get around it would have been going way all the way to the right. So the problem is the police officer and three or four people were over there all the way to the right, and they've got debris strewn across the road. But then you've got like a median that's probably about 15, 20 feet across. And there's like some parts of the median that are easy to cross, some parts that are like damn near impossible, and then some parts where it's just like wide open and you can just waltz across. So the easier part, they can just waltz across with maybe like 20 feet away from the car. So trying to gauge the situation, see if there's anybody that needed any help. While also trying to see like, hey, how do I just clear this? Because, you know, it is a pretty wide area, and, you know, it's not like impossible to get around. I mean, it's very, very easy to get around. So, you know, so then all of a sudden the police officer just, you know, starts running over to me and dropping about 50 F-bombs my way. Like, what the F are you doing? Get the F out of here. This is my effing scene. Don't you ever F and blah, blah. I mean, just going effing nuts on me. And, you know, by the speed that he was running at me, I was like, man, is there like a Dunkin' Donuts truck behind me or something? You know, this guy like would just had this like hatred in his eyes. And he starts, you know, and I'm trying to just tell him, hey, man, I'm just trying to help. You know, I've rescued somebody before. And I'm trying to, you know, but I'm not even able to get this out. And he's like, what'd you take a car would you drive your car past here? I'm like, well, that's an interesting hypothetical because I'm not in a car right now. And seeing as how I couldn't get by in a car and I can on a bike, then that doesn't make any sense. And he's just like, just starts going nuts. He's like, what do you think you're doing over here? And I was like, well, odds are only one of us in this city's probably ever brought, one of us, odds are pretty overwhelming, only one of us ever brought someone back from the dead. And I was just trying to help. And so then he's just like, get the F out of here. He's like, why don't you, I'm like, well, what way do you want me to go? He's like, well, go. So he told me to basically bike in the wrong direction on a street. And meanwhile, I was just trying to see if I can go help. But I really thought if I were to say like one word out of line, this guy would have like tackled me or would have, you know, tased me or even shot me at that point. Or I thought like he was going to arrest me. And here is the situation. So either the situation was not that dangerous, and it's not like there was like a car on fire about to blow up or anything. So it's either it was not that dangerous and, you know, he can take time out of this situation to come bitch at me, or it was so dangerous that he decided to then leave the dangerous situation to also come bitch at me. So either way, doesn't make any sense. And I probably biked a good 2.5 miles before the rest of the cavalry had shown up in the, you know, in the form of all the other, you know, rescue vehicles and ambulances and fire departments. Because again, I was in a pretty remote area. And some people are like, oh, well, you know, you weren't shot, so you don't have anything to complain about. You know, here I am, 2014, Maricopa County, you know, Lifesaver Award, you know, recognized as a hero in that exact same area. And you've got this guy acting like I just, you know, robbed a bank or just like murdered his family. Just, you know, absolutely irate at me. And with this hatred in his eyes, like, you know, I'm God. You know, everything I say goes. And I didn't do anything to defy him. I mean, he didn't, you know, he just, and it's not like there was like a big sign up that said, you know, don't cross this, or there was no like police tape. There was no, none of that. I mean, and so, you know, here I am, you know, the sun's going down in probably about an hour and a half. And it would have taken me like probably a good 2 hours to bike the detour around that. I could have easily crossed the other side of the road, which is what I did. But I had to like first clear this one part of the median that was like, had a barrier up against it, and there's cactuses and gigantic rocks. So anyway, there's some parts that's easy to cross, some that aren't. I was going to go to the part that was easy to cross because the other part of this fast was it was pretty hot that day, and I only had probably 10 ounces of water left on me. So what, I'm supposed to bike probably at least, I'm guessing here, but probably 15, 20 miles before the nearest water if I went one way, and if I went the other way, probably not till 40 miles. So, you know, that wasn't going to cut it. I would have had to bike home in the dark. I would have missed the marriage retreat. So I probably at this point had about an hour and 10 minutes before I had to be at the retreat. I was probably about, you know, 15-minute bike ride because a lot of it at that point was going to be downhill to go home and, you know, just take a quick shower and head to this retreat. So I still had plenty of time. But I'm supposed to arbitrarily wait there and not cross the road while I'm on a bike where there's a huge amount of open expanse where I could easily cross because – there's either a situation that's so dangerous nobody can cross it and you've got to leave your dangerous situation to come bitch me out, or it's not that dangerous and you just want to act like you're God and how dare anybody cross your imaginary line. Because, you know, in the old days, you know, the police should not have this attitude where it's automatically, you know, everyone else is a slave, everyone else has to submit to whatever they say because a lot of times they don't even know the law. A lot of times, you know, they're just yes men. And, you know, I want to get back to this 1950s scenario where people are, you know, actual public servants. The police are public servants, not the other way around. I'm the one paying your taxes, not the other way around. So how dare you treat me as if I'm some sort of scum, like I'm some sort of prisoner, because all I was trying to do was help out. I wasn't even that close to the situation because I was all the way to the left-hand side of the road, whereas he was all the way to the right-hand side because I didn't want to deal with him because I knew that they're probably off their rockers, or at least, you know, every few that you get off are off their rocker, to act like everyone is automatically a suspect. And again, I was in a very, very, the area that I was in was probably 98% white with a average home value probably close to $400,000 with a crime rate that's next to nothing. So it's not like I'm talking to some cop from, you know, Compton, California or something. I'm talking to someone that has probably a super cushy job up in northern Peoria where like almost nothing. I'll leave you guys on this. If I would have talked to him in the same way that he would have talked to me, if I would have talked to him at 50% of the viciousness he talked to me, I would have been shot. You got that, I would have been shot. And it would have been justified because he was scared, and police these days are because, you know, all they have to do is say that they were scared or he was reaching for a gun, and oh my God, you know, we've got carte blanche to just go kill everybody. And the last thing, again, I know I just said the last thing, but the last thing I really want to leave you with and how all this really got started is right before I went on that bike ride, I commented on a firefighter's post who mentioned something about how the SWAT team in Florida got reprimanded because there were SWAT officers who went into the Florida school shooting and helped rescue people while the actual police there, the Broward County sheriffs, were sitting outside like pussies doing nothing. And people were commenting about how it was right for those SWAT officers to get reprimanded and to get in trouble. And so, you know, we should be in a situation where we should not always have to rely on the police. The police do not actually have any obligation to protect you.
So this is actually the first time I've ever made an addendum to a podcast or gone back and edited a podcast, because one thing that I don't think I did a good job of conveying is really the fact that sometimes the people who do the most disservice to the police and put the police lives in the most danger are actual bad police and actual people that will stand up for the police no matter what. Now, they have a tough job. It's a job that I don't want. It's a job that, you know, I don't even know if I could handle, because I might have a temper and be in situations that, you know, after dealing with, you know, the dregs of society all day, you know, I might snap like that guy did snap at me, but that's why I'm not a police officer. However, I don't automatically go around hating all police officers. I don't automatically go around hating all of anybody. And just like how I think that the people who support Trump no matter what and support him at all cost, I think that those are the people who are doing the most disservice to the president and doing the most disservice to causes that they want to support, whether they are righteous or whether you agree with those causes or not, that the people who aren't willing to keep him on the straight and narrow are the people who are willing to compromise and are the people who are going to make sure that he's not president. So it all comes down to hypocrisy. It all comes down to the golden rule. You know, if you don't want somebody, you know, automatically screaming at you and getting down your throat and wanting to kill you, well, then don't act like that to other people. And if you want to then, you know, call out, let's say, Hillary for things and call out Obama for things, and then you don't want to call out Republicans for those same things, then, you know, I think that you're a hypocrite. And I think there's hypocrites when it comes to the political spectrum, and there's hypocrites when it comes to the police. And I just judge things on a case-by-case basis. And really, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, the people that I think that blame the police for everything are just as dumb as the people who don't blame them for anything. And that's really the message I wanted to convey. I originally recorded this when I was still very angry. You know, I've had about 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks now to calm down a little bit. And, you know, I just hope that, you know, I don't want to make enemies with the police, because I know that's a no-win situation doing that. But I also, at the same point, don't want to give them a free pass, you know, especially when it comes down to that one case that was down in Mesa, where you've got a guy who had a BB gun, it didn't even have it on him, and then he was murdered in cold blood. And for anyone who thinks otherwise, you know, I would really implore you to watch that video and just, you know, make sure you're not eating when you're watching that, or make sure you don't have small kids, because, you know, I hate seeing innocent lives being taken. I hate when people are bullied, and maybe it is only a small percentage of people in uniform, but, you know, to ignore that it's that happening is doing a disservice to all the good police that are out there. So that's my final message. Hope this didn't come across as too harsh, but at the same point, you know, I really felt that my life was in danger. I felt that I had a good chance of being assaulted by the police, and, you know, luckily my tan isn't that heavy right now, or else maybe it would have. Take care.